Well, it's good to be back this afternoon. We are continuing our study through the book of Judges, and we have now made it to Judges chapter 10. So if you want to open your Bibles to Judges chapter 10, you can follow along with the verses that we'll be covering this afternoon. But so far, we have covered five different judges: Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, and Deborah. And we have covered one self-appointed king, Abimelech. And as we talked about, Abimelech's story is really Gideon part two. Abimelech was not actually a judge that God chose, but Abimelech was a lot like Gideon, except without the mask. He embraced the title of king and pursued the title of king. And after the conclusion of Abimelech's story, now we will move on tonight, where the emphasis will be Jephthah. And hopefully what you've been able to see throughout the book of Judges so far is that as Israel goes through this cycle over and over of sinning and slavery and crying out to God and being rescued from their sins and then going back to them again, that over and over again, it's like Israel doesn't quite get back up to where they had fallen from. It's more like a downward spiral than it is a true cycle. And it's not only Israel that continues to spiral lower and lower as a people, but their leaders continue to get worse and worse as the cycles go on. And I think that becomes very clear when we look at these last two judges that the book gives attention to, Jephthah and Samson. But first of all, as we get into Jephthah's story, it's contained in Judges chapters 10 through 12. And I just want to show you something about the way his story is framed. So the very first five verses of chapter 10 are very similar to the way chapter 12 ends. And I want to read those verses with you. So let's begin by looking at chapter 10, verse 1. After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Pua, son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. And he lived at Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim. And he judged Israel 23 years. Then he died and was buried at Shamir. After him arose Jair, the Gileadite, who judged Israel 22 years. And he had 30 sons who rode on 30 donkeys, and they had 30 cities, called Havoth Jair to this day, which are in the land of Gilead. And Jair died and was buried in Cammon. So that's the way that the introduction starts in chapter 10, where we have these two judges that are mentioned very briefly, not much said about them, Tola and Jair. But now look at chapter 12, and this is after the conclusion of Jephthah's story. Chapter 12, beginning in verse 8. After him, Ibzan of Bethlehem judged Israel. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters he gave in marriage outside his clan, and 30 daughters he brought in from outside for his sons, and he judged Israel 7 years. Then Ibzan died and was buried at Bethlehem. After him, Elon the Zebulunite judged Israel, and he judged Israel 10 years. Then Elon the Zebulunite died and was buried in Aijalon in the land of Zebulun. After him, Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Parathonite, judged Israel. He had 40 sons and 30 grandsons who rode on 70 donkeys, and he judged Israel 8 years. Then Abdon, the son of Hillel, the Parathonite, died and was buried at Pirathon in the land of Ephraim in the hill country of the Amalekites. So what I want you to notice is that before and after Jephthah's story, we have these very brief mentions of judges, two at the very beginning and three at the very end. And Judges is like this, where sometimes it just sort of gives us a really brief little spurt of information about a judge, and then other times we have several chapters going into their stories. But when you think about those five judges, the two at the beginning of Jephthah's story and the three at the end, it seems sort of sad to me that that's really all that we're told about them. And I wonder if the implication is that there's just not a lot of meat to report about them. You know, like that's just sort of their whole legacy. They had a certain number of kids and they had a certain number of donkeys, and may they rest in peace. It's kind of all there is to say. There's not a whole lot to celebrate about them. You ever been to a funeral where it was clear that the people that were speaking were just kind of struggling with what to say about the person? I've been to a few like that. You know, where the person, somebody gets up to share some thoughts about the person that's deceased, And they just sort of say things like, well, Greg had 12 grandchildren. He was a good fisherman. He loved watching college football. Man, he really loved his motorcycle. And that's kind of all there is to say about Greg. And those funerals are really sad, because it just shows that somebody lived their whole life and didn't really have much meaningful, there wasn't much meaningful things that could be said. But think about somebody like Tabitha or Dorcas in Acts chapter 9. Do you remember that when she died, that she was remembered for being full of good works and acts of charity? Widows showed up holding the garments that she had made for them while she was still with them. That's a life that was well spent. That's a legacy that I think we would be happy to leave behind. And so when we see these brief mentions of these judges, I think that one thing we can think about is the legacy that we're leaving behind. What is it that people will say about us? What is it that people will remember you for? Hopefully it's for acts of charity like Dorcas, and not simply the number of children or donkeys that you accumulated in your life. Now, with all that being said, we are going to look at Jephthah's story beginning here in chapter 10 and verse 6. So let's go ahead and read 10 verses 6 through 14, and this introduces the story for us. In verse 6, it says, "The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and served the Baals and the Ashtaroth, the gods of Syria, the gods of Sidon, the gods of Moab, the gods of the Ammonites, and the gods of the Philistines. And they forsook the Lord and did not serve him. So the anger of the Lord was kindled against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the Ammonites. And they crushed and oppressed the people of Israel that year. For 18 years they oppressed all the people of Israel who were beyond the Jordan in the land of the Amorites, which is in Gilead. And the Ammonites crossed the Jordan to fight also against Judah and against Benjamin and against the house of Ephraim, so that Israel was severely distressed. And the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, saying, 'We have sinned against you, because we have forsaken our God and served the Baals.' And the Lord said to the people of Israel, 'Did I not save you from the Egyptians and from the Amorites, from the Ammonites and from the Philistines? The Sidonians also, and the Amalekites and the Maonites oppressed you, and you cried out to me, and I saved you out of their hand. Yet you have forsaken me and served other gods. Therefore I will save you no more. Go and cry out to the gods whom you have chosen. Let them save you in the time of your distress.'" So you stop there for just a moment, and what we see is our familiar cycle in the book of Judges starting up again. In verse 6, we see Israel's sin. In verses 7 through 9, we see the slavery that God allows them to go into. In verse 10, we see the supplication where they cry out to the Lord. And you might be expecting salvation to follow, where God responds by sending a judge to deliver them from their enemies. But that's not what happens this time. In fact, that wasn't exactly what happened the last time either. The last time that we saw this cycle play out was in chapter 6. And it was before God selected Gideon. And remember that before God made Gideon rise up to save the people, he sent a prophet to them, telling them that really the problem is their sinfulness. And here in chapter 10, it's the same sort of thing, except God doesn't send a prophet. Apparently, he speaks to them directly. And at this point, it's not really clear whether God will save them at all. And he makes a good point, you know? Here's Israel in distress. Here they are reaping the benefits, or the consequences, really, of their actions. And God says, "Well, you didn't want anything to do with me earlier. Why do you want me now? Why don't you turn to those other gods that you wanted so much? Let them save you." And he kind of just lets that ruminate for a few moments. But now you see Israel's response in verse 15. In verse 15, the people of Israel said to the Lord, "We have sinned. Do to us whatever seems good to you. Only please deliver us this day." So they put away the foreign gods from among them and served the Lord, and he became impatient over the misery of Israel. Then the Ammonites were called to arms, and they encamped in Gilead, and the people of Israel came together, and they encamped at Mizpah. And the people, the leaders of Gilead, said to one another, "Who is the man who will begin to fight against the Ammonites? He shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead." So notice that the people do two things in response to God's message. First of all, they put their idols away. And second of all, they begin to look for a leader. Now, I want to suggest that neither one of these things was really done in the right way. For one, I have serious doubts about the sincerity of Israel's repentance. Most times in the book of Judges, I think that's generally a safe bet, that there's something out of place. But one question that immediately comes to mind about this is, well, why didn't they put their idols away before they cried out to him? You know, if they had the desperation to call out to God and say, God, we need you to save us, it seems like it would be sort of intuitive that you would put your idols away first. But God has to respond, and then they decide to put their idols away. And now that God seems iffy about helping them, it seems that they'll do whatever they have to do just in order to sway his thoughts, to manipulate God to be on their side. You see, real repentance is choosing to turn away from sin out of a sincere devotion to God, not just trying to get God or get on God's good side, not trying to just simply manipulate God to do what you want him to do. And so it seems like they don't really want to serve him. They simply want him to save them. But for another, why have they taken it upon themselves to select a leader? Remember, that was the other thing that they did. They began to ask among themselves, well, who is it that's going to be our leader? You know, in previous cycles, God is the one who has selected the judges. God is the one who has chosen them and risen them up to be the deliverers. It's never been up to Israel to put their heads together and say, who's going to be the guy? If you go back to the very beginning of Judges, though, look in Judges chapter 1 and the very first verse. Judges 1 and verse 1 says, after the death of Joshua, the people of Israel inquired of the Lord, who shall go up first for us against the Canaanites to fight against them? Now, at the very beginning of this book, it's a similar scene where the people of Israel are inquiring, who's going to be the one to go up? But you saw the difference, didn't you? In chapter 1, they inquired of the Lord. Here in chapter 10, they're inquiring of one another. And so, the two things that they do seem to be a little bit lacking. And now, this is how Jephthah enters the scene. So let's begin reading here in chapter 11, verses 1 through 11. Now, Jephthah the Gileadite was a mighty warrior, but he was the son of a prostitute. Gilead was the father of Jephthah, and Gilead's wife also bore him sons. And when his wife's sons grew up, they drove Jephthah out and said to him, you shall not have an inheritance in our father's house, for you are the son of another woman. Then Jephthah fled from his brothers and lived in the land of Tob. And worthless fellows collected around Jephthah and went out with him. After a time, the Ammonites made war against Israel. And when the Ammonites made war against Israel, the elders of Gilead went to bring Jephthah from the land of Tob. And they said to Jephthah, come and be our leader that we may fight against the Ammonites. But Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, did you not hate me and drive me out of my father's house? Why have you come to me now when you're in distress? And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, that is why we have turned to you now, that you may go with us and fight against the Ammonites and be our head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. Jephthah said to the elders of Gilead, if you bring me home again to fight against the Ammonites and the Lord gives them over to me, I will be your head. And the elders of Gilead said to Jephthah, the Lord will be witness between us if we do not do as you say. So Jephthah went with the elders of Gilead, and the people made him head and leader over them. And Jephthah spoke all his words before the Lord at Mizpah. So think about this with me for just a moment. The people of Israel decide they don't want anything to do with Jephthah. They run him out of town until they need him, right? Until they're in distress. And when they're in distress, they're quick to go running to Jephthah and say, oh, we do want you after all. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? The people of Israel are treating Jephthah exactly the way that they've treated God. And Jephthah's response is very similar to God's response. God said, why do you want me now? Turn to those other gods to save you. Jephthah says, you didn't want me then. What is it that's different now? Why do you want me now? The people are treating Jephthah the same way they've treated God. You know, that tends to be the case. We tend to treat God no better than we treat each other. In 1 John chapter 4, in verse 20, John writes, if anyone says, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot love God whom he has not seen. And so, much like the people of Israel, we can be guilty of the same things. That if we don't treat God the right way, then we will not treat those who are made in his image the right way either. But another thing to notice in this section is all of this talk about making Jephthah their head. In chapter 10, in verse 18, the question was, or the statement was, he shall be head over all the inhabitants of Gilead. In chapter 11, in verse 6, they say to Jephthah, come and be our leader. In chapter 11, in verse 8, they say, that's why we've turned to you, that you may go and fight with us and be our head. In verse 9, Jephthah says, if the Lord gives them over to me, I will be your head. And finally, in verse 11, Jephthah went with them, and the people made him head and leader over them. You see, one thing that the people realize about Jephthah is that if Jephthah saves them, if Jephthah actually delivers them from their enemies, that he's worthy of their devotion, that he deserves to be their leader. And so one thing that they're acknowledging about Jephthah is the one thing that they've failed to acknowledge about God over and over. God has saved them. God has delivered them. God has given them freedom from their captors. And over again, God has shown them that he's worthy to be their leader. And yet, they have not followed him. Well, we're going to summarize this next section. In verses 12 through 28, what happens is, in verse 12, that Jephthah sends messengers to the king of the Ammonites and says to them, what do you have against me that you have come to me to fight against my land? So there's this crisis that's brewing with the people of Israel versus the Ammonites. And Jephthah agrees to be the leader of Israel to deliver them from their enemies. But he starts by attempting some diplomacy. And this is probably Jephthah's greatest moment. And I'm sorry that we're going to have to sort of summarize what he says. You can read it on your own time. But he makes some very persuasive arguments to the king of the Ammonites. And basically, he tries to reason with him, shows great skill in communication and conflict resolution. He explains that Israel never took land away from the Ammonites, so there's not really any conflict that actually exists, except in the king of the Ammonites' mind. He explains that the land that Israel does have is land that God had given them. And so if God had given it to them, then he has no responsibility to give it away. And finally, he ends by talking about how the nature of this dispute is about something that happened 300 years ago. And so he says, look, if there was really any rightful claim by the Ammonites on this land, you've had 300 years to deal with it. Why are you bringing it up now? And so Jephthah makes some really persuasive arguments to show him that it doesn't have to be like this. There doesn't have to be a battle that takes place. And so in verse 28, we see the king of the Ammonites' response, though. Verse 28 says, but the king of the Ammonites did not listen to the words of Jephthah that he sent to him. There's going to have to be war. But one thing that I think is helpful to see is that even if it doesn't work out, even if diplomacy doesn't solve the conflict here, that Jephthah shows that he's capable of thinking logically and seeking peace. And that will be quite the contrast with how his story ends. Now, one other thing that I want to notice in this section is what Jephthah says in verse 27. Jephthah says something here tucked into this presentation that's very interesting. And in Judges 11:27, he refers to God, and he says, the Lord, the judge, decide this day between the people of Israel and the people of Ammon. You know, that's a very profound statement. And I don't think that Jephthah even realized how profound it was, or how perceptive he was. We name this book Judges, and we talk about all of the different human judges that God used to deliver his people. And over again, we see how weak and flawed they are. But the true judge of this book is the Lord. And as we see all of the failures of these human judges that he raises up, they just highlight the perfection of the true judge. The only one who can truly deliver the people from their problems is him. Now, let's see what happens next, though. This is probably the section of Jephthah's story that you're most familiar with. And let's read, beginning here in verse 29. Then the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah, and he passed through Gilead and Manasseh and passed on to Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah of Gilead, he passed on to the Ammonites. And Jephthah made a vow to the Lord and said, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's. And I will offer it up for a burnt offering. So Jephthah crossed over to the Ammonites to fight against them, and the Lord gave them into his hand. And he struck them from Aroer to the neighborhood of Minnith, 20 cities, and as far as Abel-Keramim with a great blow. So the Ammonites were subdued before the people of Israel. Then Jephthah came to his home at Mizpah, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with tambourines and with dances. She was his only child. Besides her, he had neither son nor daughter. And as soon as he saw her, he tore his clothes and said, alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low. And you have become the cause of great trouble to me. For I have opened my mouth to the Lord, and I cannot take back my vow. And she said to him, my father, you have opened your mouth to the Lord. Do to me according to what has gone out of your mouth, now that the Lord has avenged you on your enemies, on the Ammonites. So she said to her father, let this thing be done for me. Leave me alone 2 months, that I may go up and down on the mountains and weep for my virginity, I and my companions. So he said, go. Then he sent her away for 2 months, and she departed, she and her companions, and wept for her virginity on the mountains. And at the end of 2 months, she returned to her father, who did with her according to his vow that he had made. She had never known a man, and it became a custom in Israel, so that the daughters of Israel went year by year to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in the year. So, this story starts out with the Spirit of the Lord descending upon Jephthah. And it tells us that he was able to go out and strike the Ammonites with a great blow. But unfortunately, the focus of this story is not Jephthah's military victory, but it's on this rash vow that he makes. Now, in verse 30, he makes this vow where he says, if you will give the Ammonites into my hand, then whatever comes out from the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the Ammonites shall be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. There's a great deal of debate about what exactly Jephthah was vowing and what exactly happened in this story. But I'm going to make the case that Jephthah fully intended to make a human sacrifice and that he followed through with it. That the most natural reading of this text is exactly what happened. I'll give you 3 reasons why I do think that this is what happened. For one, he vows to offer whatever or whoever comes out from the doors of his house to meet him. Now, if he had an animal in mind, I don't think he would have described it as coming out of the doors of his house to meet him. Unless, you know, he had a golden retriever, and they don't typically have those in ancient biblical times. So he's talking about something coming out of his house to meet him. Secondly, it seems like Jephthah is describing something that should be considered extraordinary, you know? Like he's offering something to God that would be exceptional, something that would really be out of the ordinary. Animal sacrifice wouldn't be out of the ordinary at all. It would just sort of be expected. You know, if God gave you the victory and you came home from war, then of course you should offer some kind of a burnt offering. But it sounds like he's wanting to do something particularly dramatic or noteworthy. But then thirdly, this word translated burnt offering is the exact same word that's used consistently in other parts of the Bible, like Leviticus, to refer to an entire animal being burned up on an altar. And so it seems to me that Jephthah fully intended to offer a human sacrifice to God, and that he followed through with it. Now, the question, of course, is why? Why would Jephthah do that? God has never desired human sacrifice. He's always seen that as an abomination. And you might think, well, what about that story with Abraham and Isaac in Genesis 22? That's the point. That's the point, is that God is seeing Abraham's faith, but stopping him to say, I'm not like these other gods. I don't delight in your human sacrifice. God wouldn't want anyone to offer their child as a burnt offering. But you know who would? The Baals would. The Ashtaroth would. The god of the Ammonites, Chemosh, would. Molech would delight in child sacrifice. You see, human sacrifice was a normal part of pagan idol worship. Now here's what I think is going on with Jephthah. I think Jephthah is showing us just how Canaanized he's become. He doesn't really understand who God is. And so he's treating God just like the way you might treat a pagan idol god. He's offering him something that he thinks God would want, because that's what pagan idol gods would want. And he thinks that he has to make some extreme vow to get God on his side. And he's offering an extreme sacrifice in an attempt to get God's attention and to impress him. And he didn't need to do any of that. Remember in verse 29, the Spirit of the Lord was upon Jephthah. All Jephthah needed to do was trust God, and God would have given him the victory. But it's because he didn't understand the character of God, that he didn't understand how to have a relationship with him. He didn't understand who God was, and he made terrible choices because of that. Do you remember when Elijah had a showdown with the prophets of Baal in 1 Kings 18? In 1 Kings 18, Elijah has this like big competition with the prophets of Baal. And remember what the prophets of Baal did to try to get their God's attention. They cried out to him all day long. And when that didn't work, they started cutting themselves with swords and lances until the blood gushed out. But what did Elijah do? Elijah prayed, and fire came down from heaven. It also reminds me of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount. In Matthew 6, when Jesus is giving us instructions about how to pray, he said in verse 7, when you pray, do not heap up empty phrases as the Gentiles do, for they think that they will be heard for their many words. Do not be like them, for your Father knows what you need before you ask him. See, one of the things that distinguishes the true living God from any of these false gods is that the true God is a God who loves us, who cares about us, who's eager to respond to us. And as Jesus says, if we're in Christ, we can call upon him as our Father. You don't have to do anything extraordinary to try to get God's attention. You just have to love him and trust him and do what he asks. And because Jephthah doesn't understand that, he makes this terrible vow. But the point of this story is not that we should be careful about making rash vows. Of course we should. But the point of this story is that we need to understand the character of God. Because if we don't, we'll never have a good relationship with him. Now, let's go on to chapter 12. And I want you to see this final story of Jephthah in verses 1 through 7. This is sort of the fallout of everything that's just happened with this conflict with the Ammonites. Verse 1 says, the men of Ephraim were called to arms, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house over you with fire. And Jephthah said to them, I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites, and when I called you, you did not save me from their hand. And when I saw that you would not save me, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites, and the Lord gave them into my hand. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me? Then Jephthah gathered all the men of Gilead, and they fought with Ephraim, And the men of Gilead struck Ephraim because they said, "You are fugitives of Ephraim, you Gileadites, in the midst of Ephraim and Manasseh." And the Gileadites captured the fords of the Jordan against the Ephraimites. And when any of the fugitives of Ephraim said, "Let me go over," the men of Gilead said to him, "Are you an Ephraimite?" When he said, "No," they said to him, "Then say Shibboleth." And he said, "Sibboleth," for he could not pronounce it right. Then they seized him and slaughtered him at the fords of the Jordan. At that time, 42,000 of the Ephraimites fell. So Jephthah's story somehow gets even sadder at the end. What we see are that the men of Ephraim are upset because Jephthah didn't call them to fight against the Ammonites. It's a very similar conflict to what happened at the beginning of chapter 8. Do you remember in chapter 8, after Gideon had been successful against his enemies, that again, it was the men of Ephraim in verse 1 who said to Gideon, what is this that you have done to us to not call us when you went to fight against Midian? And they accused him fiercely. But back in chapter 8, what Gideon does is he diffuses the situation with his soft answer. Like the proverb says, he turns away their wrath. And he is able to calm down those Ephraimites for being so upset about not being called to the battle. Very different to what Jephthah does. He escalates the situation with an answer that's very harsh. In verse 2, "I and my people had a great dispute with the Ammonites. When I called you, you didn't save me from their hand. When I saw that you would not save me, I took my life in my hand and crossed over against the Ammonites. Why then have you come up to me this day to fight against me?" And if you'll notice, Jephthah's response has a lot of "I and me" kinds of words in it. Why are you upset with me? I did it all by myself. And Jephthah's answer is not only harsh, but it's also self-centered. And what ends up happening is that Jephthah's men capture the fords of the Jordan. So the river, the Jordan River, would be a place that you could only cross at certain shallow points. And so you've got the men of Ephraim that are on the east side of the river, and they want to get back over to the west side. And so Jephthah and the men of Gilead capture those points where they would have to cross. And they set up these little security checkpoints. And the security checkpoint has a secret password. Except the password's not really secret, but you just have to be able to say it the right way. And they say, "Say the word Shibboleth." But because of the Ephraimites' culture or language, they weren't able to pronounce it correctly. And so they would reveal that they were actually Ephraimites. Their accent would betray them. It would be sort of like if I asked you how to pronounce this word on the screen. Those of you who are from New York or other places would think that this word is the word Albany. But if you are born and raised in Georgia, you would probably pronounce it Albany or something like that. And so, you know, when somebody pronounces Albany, Georgia, well, then you know that they probably have some familiarity with the state of Georgia. If they pronounce it as Albany, then there's a chance that, you know, they're from somewhere else. But it's the same kind of thing that's happening here, is that based on the way that they say Shibboleth, they reveal whether they're Ephraimites or whether they're not. But what ends up happening is that 42,000 Ephraimites die at the fords of the Jordan. Don't gloss over that number. That is the largest single instance of Israelite casualties in the whole book of Judges. And it's not at the hands of a foreign enemy, but it's at the hands of fellow Israelites. It's tragic. And so, let's draw some applications from this story. The first one that we should remember is that God is worthy of our full devotion. Israel only seemed to care about God when they realized that they needed something from him. It was only when they were in distress that they realized that their idols couldn't save them. Don't make the same mistake. We can make idols out of anything. You can make idols out of your career, out of your family, out of your hobbies, out of your country. Don't wait until those idols fail you before you turn to God. Decide to serve him first. He's the only one who will be able to deliver you through whatever hardships you face. And so realize before you're forced to that God is worthy of your full devotion. Secondly, knowing and understanding God is crucial to our relationship with Him. As I said in the story about the vow in chapter 11, I believe the lesson of that story is not just be careful and don't make foolish vows. The lesson from that story is make sure that you know and understand God. It was because Jephthah didn't understand God's character that he treated him as if he was some pagan idol god. And so the story shows us that theology matters. Good theology is crucial to a good relationship with God. We need to understand and know Him in order to really serve Him the way that He wants us to. And then number three, pride turns conflicts into catastrophes. When you see the way that Jephthah deals with these men of Ephraim in chapter 12, it calls to mind the way Gideon dealt with the men of Ephraim in chapter 8. And in chapter 8, that conflict was so easily resolved with no bloodshed. But instead, we have 42,000 Ephraimites dying here in chapter 12. And as we pointed out, it seems like Jephthah's pride is at play. He talks about what he's done, and his pride escalates the situation, and it becomes a disaster. And if we're not careful, we can make the same mistake. No matter what the relationship is, there will always be points of conflict in human relationships. Whether it's your marriage, whether it's your friendships, whether it's your relationships with your brothers and sisters here, there's going to be times where I say something the wrong way or you say something the wrong way, and there's just some tension. Realize that pride is what turns conflicts into catastrophes. But humility minimizes them and diffuses them. It's pride that blows things out of proportion and leads to all kinds of unnecessary destruction. And so let's be aware of that. And let's not allow pride to be the reason why our relationships become damaged or broken. I heard a preacher say one time, you can't humiliate a humble man. And that's always stuck with me. When we have true humility, we won't be easily offended. We'll let things roll off our backs. And conflicts are much more easily resolved that way. Again, I hope that you see as we look at these ancient stories that these lessons that we can gain from them are lessons that are imminently practical for us today. Let's learn from Jephthah, and let's be people who seek to know and understand God, and let's be people who live in a relationship with Him in faith and in confidence, not in doubt and insecurity. There might be somebody here this afternoon who needs to make your relationship with God right. If you want to come to God through Jesus and be His child, you can make that decision tonight. If you need to make your life right with God in some other way, and we can help you with that, you have an opportunity before you leave. Please come to the front while we stand and sing.